Torah, and hopefully this one will be as well. But I will give a two-minute recap just to how we got into this topic, and hopefully you'll find the subjects we'll discuss tonight very interesting in their own right, independent of what we discussed last week. So the way we got into the topic of changes in the world and how they affect halacha, changes in science, changes in nature, is that we find in the Mefarshim, on Parshas Noach last week, that there were drastic, dramatic changes in that took place in the natural world after the time of the flood, after the Mabul. In particular, one thing we focused on was that we find that the climate around the globe changed dramatically after the Mabul. The Medrash tells us that it used to be, before the flood, you could plant once every 40 years, and that was enough to satisfy whatever needs they had, crops, growing things, farms, once every 40 years. And the reason was because the Earth did not have the 23-degree axis that it spins on today. It wasn't tilted. It spun normally, straight. And as a result, there was no reason to have different seasons. Winter and summer, and everything was basically springtime the entire year, and that was a healthy environment for things to grow very very nicely, and again, with limited effort. But as time went on, the quality of life of the world, little by little, was downgraded. And one of the other markers for that is that we find that the longevity, the lifespan of people over the course of the centuries, also went down dramatically. Hundreds of years, people used to live almost 1,000 years, and now it's much closer to 70, 80, 90 years, and that's about it. Okay, so what we covered last week was basically to take that impetus, talking about natural change in Parshas Noach, and talk about in Halacha how the changes in nature, changes in science can affect things. We spent the entire time talking about fish and meat and the practice that we find in Shulchan Aruch based on the Gemaras, not to eat fish and meat together, even though that seems to be something which the Gemara deems as dangerous, and it's not a danger that we can really pinpoint with our science today. Nevertheless, it is a practice that is observed very widely amongst the religious Jews. And we spoke about some of the practical applications, including the hashkacha that the OU gives to Heinz Worcestershire sauce, which is a steak sauce, which is supposed to include anchovies. If you missed it last week, you have at least part of the story on the back of the source sheets, OU document F41. And again, for the full story, you got to listen to the shiur from last week. Okay, so we're going to move on. Yeah, go ahead.
I wasn't here last week, but apparently there is a thing with fish and meat, and there are people who will not use the same equipment for both.
Right, okay, so we didn't even get into using the same equipment, using the same dishes, because even those who don't actually eat fish and meat together, or they will wash out their mouth in between the gefilte fish and the main meal, so generally people use the same utensils as long as they're clean. There is a practice recorded in your day in Shulchan Aruch where some people had a separate...
I mean, like non-Jews.
Oh, non-Jews. Oh, really?
For health reasons.
Oh, okay, so
yeah,
please,
if you... You can get color-coded cutting boards, because when you cut into something with it...
That's fascinating.
The stuff gets left behind.
Okay, so please, if you can give me a link or something in print, I would love to see it. That's very interesting. Okay. So we're gonna move into a different area of kashrus also, for tonight, number one. But we'll cover a whole gamut of different subjects if we are able to do it in the next 50 minutes or so. Okay, so I want to talk about stainless steel. Okay, so in a kosher home, it's common practice to find, as many as three now, but for sure two sets of dishes for milk and meat. Obviously, you'll have some parva utensils, but generally people have a lot less of those than their milks and fleishiks, and we'll leave Pesach on the side. But this is all based on the concept that we have in halacha known as tam ki'ikar. Tam ki'ikar, that the taste of something is treated in halacha as if it is the item itself. Namely, if you have chicken and you cook the chicken in a pot, so the taste of the chicken enters the walls of the pot, and as a result, I wouldn't be able to use that pot, again, for milkshakes, for dairy, in the same way I wouldn't be able to cook, melt cheese on top of the chicken, because that would be a violation of the laws of basar b'chalav. Okay, the way we know that is because the formulation for the prohibition of milk and meat, as found three times in the Torah, is Lo sevashal gedi b'chalev imo. Lo sevashal gedi b'chalev imo. You shall not cook the meat of the animal in the mother's milk. Okay, so the fact that the Torah uses that term cooking specifically implies that there's something, again, unique about the cooking process that makes it happen. Namely, the Gemara actually gives the following example. Let's say I had a cold piece of a cold steak, and I put it in a bucket with milk, and I left it there for the whole afternoon. If I wanted to, in theory, I could take that the milk out of the bucket, pour a glass for myself, eat it, drink it, no problem. And the meat also, if I could clean it properly, would be fine to then go and put in the oven and eat that night for dinner. As long as everything's cold, strictly speaking, on a Torah level, on a Doraisa level, no problems are created. Therefore, the same would be true if I had a salami sandwich with cheese. From the Torah's perspective, a salami sandwich with cheese is 100% permitted. It's 100% mutter. It was only something that later on the rabbis came and prohibited, because obviously it's a small step between that and melting the cheese on the salami, which is what we're getting at. Lo sevashal gadiba chalev imo. The fact that the Torah phrases it using the cooking reference is what tells us where the prohibition is. It's with cooking, and the Gemara defines that as derech bishal asr Torah, in the manner in which we cook things. What's the point of cooking things? One of the reasons you cook things is because that helps transfer the taste between the two items that are being cooked together. You put meat in, or chicken, put the chicken in a pot to make chicken soup, because obviously the heat causes the flavor of the chicken to be extracted, and it enters the broth, which you eat as chicken soup. So the transfer of taste is only when you have heat present. All right, that's number one. Number two, even if we leave the realm of milk and meat when it comes to non-kosher things, the same is true. If you would buy a used pot from a non-Jew, and you have to assume that he's been using that pot for non-kosher foods, so you would not be able to then go ahead and cook your kosher foods in it, because we assume that some of the flavor escapes from the non-kosher food, enters the pot, and goes back into your food that you cook there. Okay, this is stuff we're all familiar with, and just for the reference, it comes from Parshas Matos. Parshas Matos describes a war that the Jews had with the Midianim, and they brought back lots of spoils from the war, among them utensils that they used in the kitchen. And the Torah says that before they could bring them home and use them, they had to go through a koshering process. Those things that were used in heat, like a pot, had to go through another a procedure of expunging the taste from the walls of the pot, namely through that same heat process. That's what we call koshering. That's what we call hagola. That's what you do before Pesach. Again, because we're trying to extract the taste that's absorbed in the walls. Okay. Again, that's just the fundamentals. Now, if I were to ask you, I understand the taste goes into the pot because there's not much space, for it to travel. It's pretty simple. How thick is the wall? How thick are the walls of a pot? A half an inch thick, maybe less, probably less than that. So how far can taste actually travel? Okay, why does this concern us? The pot's the pot. What is there to talk about? But if you go to a restaurant, some people have it in their homes also. But if you go to a restaurant, so sometimes you see these pots with a handle that's 10 inches long or longer than that, hanging above the range. Or you can have a frying pan also with a very long handle attached to it. So let's say I cook something that's non kosher in the pot. Do you assume that the taste travels all the way out to to the extent of how far the handle of the pot or whatever it is happens to extend? In a much larger scale, this is a very real practical halachic shaila. So let's say things like cottonseed oil. Okay, I'm not an expert on these things, but I understand something like cottonseed oil, other vegetable oils are very often imported to America, to other countries, from places as far as Mongolia. Okay, they're cheaply produced in faraway countries, and they transport them on these huge tankers, these huge boats. And these boats can have vats where they're transporting the oils, and the vat can be several times the size of this room. Okay, it's not just a little pot; it's a huge hold of a tanker. Now, as you can imagine, if you have a tanker which is hundreds of feet long, so they have many of these huge vats that they're transporting. They're not all carrying cottonseed oil. You might, in the hold right next to the cottonseed oil, you might have oil that's derived from non-kosher animals, which obviously you have to reckon with the kosher factor. So now the room, it's hard to call it a vat. It's really like a room that's holding the cottonseed oil, maybe separated from the vat that's holding the non-kosher animal-derived oil, with a wall that could be several feet thick. Okay, so often they have to be transported at high temperatures to preserve their integrity. So do you say that the taste can transfer through a wall several feet thick? Okay, or do you say no? There's just like the example again on a smaller scale in the kitchen of the handle of a pot. Is there some way where we draw some place at which we draw the line? So just because we're on the topic of Torah and science, the whole concept of Tom transferring into pot is not something that's some sort of spooky voodoo or whatever, which some people have that approach. There, on a simple level, there is a concept known as. The difference between cast iron pots and stainless steel pots, which cast iron pots are used by culinary experts and are designed to absorb some of the flavor, and that will come out over time in the in whatever's cooked in the pot. But the OU actually commissioned an experiment where they, with the help of metallurgists, people know a lot about metals, they treated food cooked in a pot with radioactive isotopes so that they could watch how far, and if at all, particles from the food that that was cooked in the pot move into the utensil, and they found that it actually can move about a quarter of an inch. Okay, that's normal when you cook something in the pot. It can go about a quarter of an inch deep into the walls of the pot. Now it's interesting because, strictly speaking, in halacha, you'd get the impression that it goes further. Getting back to our question of the pot with the long handle. So we seem to find two different opinions. The Taz, one of the primary commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, says that there has to be some line where you draw, whereas the Chassam Sofer and reportedly Rav Moshe Feinstein held that, no, we have to assume that it goes all the way. As far as, in theory, it makes sense for something to travel, it can go that far. Even, again, if you have walls of a pot, that's not even a pot anymore, that's several feet thick. The most extreme application of this question, which, again, discussed in the postgame, is let's say I live in an apartment building, and it's Pesach time. So somewhere down in the basement or somewhere, in the walls, everyone's pipes are connected somehow. Ultimately, you get to the boiler, ultimately you get to the sewage system. Somewhere there's a connection, at least to some degree, between the different pipes. So do you have to be worried that my kashrus, my Pesach kitchen, is compromised because there could be someone else in the apartment building who's cooking something that's chametz stick, and something is traveling back up to my kitchen. So that's a little bit, again, as I said, that's all the way on the extreme. I don't think I've never met anyone who's practically done anything to prevent the other people in the building from cooking on Pesach. But that is the logical extreme of where we can go with this. So bottom line, okay, yeah, go ahead.
Good question. It's a little bit far-fetched, but did anyone say that the concept of Tom Kicker, that if you have a pot and you cook something dairy in that pot, and there's nothing else in that pot, and you cook something meat in that pot, and then you, I guess, never mind.
Okay, we can come back to it later. So another OU document, number K354, if you're keeping score at home, it's not on the page, but Rabbi Schechter, he's one of the postkin for the OU, recorded his opinion that he held that beyond 6 inches you don't have to be concerned. It was based on this experiment, but beyond 6 inches he didn't think there was reason to be concerned. But let's talk about stainless steel. Okay, so stainless steel is really a metal that didn't exist the way we have it in time of Chazal. And based on its physical chemical properties, I think mainly because it's treated, it has a chromium component to it. Its primary characteristic is that it prevents surface corrosion, which is why sometimes stainless steel is used in buildings. The big arch in St. Louis is covered in stainless steel. So I guess that's why it's out there and doesn't rust. No one has to polish it. The top of the Chrysler Building downtown also is plated with stainless steel. So the same is true with the pots in the kitchen. The stainless steel is useful because it doesn't rust. It's not supposed to rust, at least. But what we would also seemingly conclude is that because it has, again, the ability to prevent penetration of chemicals and other things, maybe we should come to the conclusion that that the rules of Tam Ki Iker, the rules of the transferring of taste, don't apply to stainless steel because nothing's supposed to get in, so it doesn't. It shouldn't. What are we worried about? So that is a question which a number of Gedolim have weighed in on, and even though the answer may leave us a little bit with a question mark, I think it's telling as to one approach, and again we'll try to bring this all together before the end of this year, one approach to take into account. Again, here's not exactly a difference in nature, as we discussed last time. Here it's a situation where the nature described by Chazal it may be consistent with the nature that we observe in front of us, but at the same time, there are different factors that may tweak our own encounter or interactions with halacha because, again, for instance, the materials of the pots that we're using are not exactly the same. Just to throw one other related point out there, this is a part of the discussion in whether or not aluminum tins, aluminum pans, disposable pans, have to be toivled. So obviously one factor is the idea that they're disposable. Okay, that's definitely one reason why most people don't toivel disposable pans. There are people who do, who live on this block. Beyond that, one factor is that aluminum was not one of the six metals detailed in the pasuk that I referenced before of the kalim that were brought back from the war with Midian. It mentioned six specific metals, and aluminum wasn't on the list because there was no periodic table with dozens of metals at the time. So some achronim hold that if it wasn't on the list originally, then it's not subject to the laws of tefillas kalim that are described in the Torah. So. What I understand is that this question was posed to Moshe Feinstein and Rebbe Yashiv regarding stainless steel, and they agreed, they weren't denying the practical reality that it may not absorb, that we see in front of us, but they said, you can't that quickly just throw out a halacha that's mentioned in the Gemara, that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. If there is a concept that requires us to behave in a certain way regarding our pots, our utensils in our kitchen, then without some sort of formal way of adjusting that system, and there are no exceptions made in the records of halacha and Shulchan Aruch, then we're not able to come along and alter that. But what that means exactly, I think, is explained a little bit by a discussion. Rabbi Lichtenstein asked this question, from what I understand, to Shlomo Zalman. From Zalman passed away under 20 years ago. So sometime before then, Ronald Lichtenstein asked this question, and what he told him was, you're right, again, and Mir Tashem, when we get the Sanhedrin together, so then we can sit down and we can reconvene and we'll reevaluate a lot of the halacha. So the struggle here is because if we're not facing the same reality, so how come we can't change things? So I think one thing which sheds a little bit of light on that statement of Shlomo Zalman gets back to Parshas Noach again. I don't think we mentioned this last week, but I think I can get away with it even if we did. Another reference to Parshas Noach. If you look in the Pesukim, so Parshas Noach, and yes, it is Parshas Lech Lecha, but it's a part two from last week. I did not forget the date, although I often do. The Parshas Noach, we find that it seems Noach was to some degree itching to get out of the teva. He's always looking out. He sends one bird, another bird, week after week to see if the earth is ready. Things have dried up enough to exit the teva. But at the same time, even after he has the evidence from the Yonah, Yonah doesn't come back. So he is able to extrapolate from there that the world is dry enough to inhabit. He still doesn't leave until Hashem explicitly tells him to do so. So why is that? So the Gemara in Beitz on Daf Hey tells us, we learn from this Gemara, from this this episode in Tanakh, in the Torah, that anytime you have a law that has an explicit statement implementing that law, it cannot be discarded or repealed unless, in the terminology of the Gemara, Davar Shebeminyan Ein Bezdin Acher Yachal Atiro, another Bezdin cannot come and take it away, Ela Imkein Gadol Mimeno B'Chachma U'Beminyan, unless that second Bezdin, the second rabbinical authority, is greater in numbers and in wisdom, which means that an earlier Takana cannot so quickly be removed unless you have a second authority that is as or maybe even greater than the original body. So therefore, what does that have to do with our statement in the story in Noach? That Hashem told Noach to go into the teva. But until Hashem actually tells Noach explicitly, okay, now it's time for you to come out and with the animals and your family come out of the teva, he was stuck inside, even though he knew that the world was dry enough to inhabit, but he had to stay inside. Another example that the Gemara brings is Matan Torah. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu tells everyone you can't go up on the mountain. Apparently, the Midrash tells us he built a fence around the mountain to prevent anyone from going up. Even the animals were not supposed to go up on the mountain. And only later, the pasuk says, "Bimsho hayovel hema yalu bahar." After you hear the shofar blow, after the shofar is finished sounding, then everyone will be permitted again to go back on the mountain. So you see from here, there sometimes you have to have an explicit repeal of the original statement, the original institution, in order to change the halacha. So I wonder if that's part of what Reb Shlomo Zalman is saying, that yes, of course we take into account the practical realities and how they've changed and how science views things, but at the same time we still need the bottom line mechanism, halachic mechanism for reversing things in some situations. Okay, maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. Let's move on to a second topic. This actually is a little more on the source sheets. I'm sorry to keep everyone off the page. But this is the question which we often face throughout the year, but particularly on Yantif, on Pesach. I'm just going to grab one for myself. And that is the question of the shiurim. Now, how much matzah do I have to eat? How much maror do I have to eat? How much do I have to drink if I'm just making kiddush on Shabbos? So the Gemara tells us in Brachos and Daf Mem Aleph that the pasuk describing Eretz Yisrael is the first step in understanding shiurim, the quantities that we require for these types of things. Pasuk says Eretz Chito Seora Gefen Teino Rimon Eretz Zeh Shemen Dvash. So there are a couple possible halachas we learn from this pasuk that describes the shiva minim. One thing we learn from the pasuk is the order in which we make brachos. Right, Chito Seora, grains, wheat, barley, etc. If you have that a grain product in front of you, and you also have something else on the list, such as a fruit, so the grain products come first because the grain products are mentioned first in the pasuk describing the sheva minim of Eretz Yisrael. Another potential halacha we learn from this pasuk, kol ha-pasuk kul l'shiurim, could be the reason why the Torah uses this formulation. In describing the bounty of Eretz Yisrael is because each one of those minim represents a halachic quantity in a different area of the Torah, and without going into the details, we can talk about it another time. But the one that concerns us for now is at the end of the pasuk, Eretz Zeis Shemen. Zeis Shemen, Zayis is an olive. So an olive size, a kezayis, is a term that basically applies to not all, but the vast majority of halachas regarding eating, whether it be a prohibition, something you're not allowed to eat. If one eats a kezayis, an olive size of that prohibited material, so then he'll receive a punishment from Beis Din. But when it comes to mitzvahs also, so the minimum amount that the person has to eat is the size of a kezayis. So everyone always asks, okay, the olives that we see are, I'm sorry?
Different sizes.
They seem to be very small, yes. The experts say that olives today are between 3 and 7.5 cubic centimeters, okay? So the truth is there are, we do have on record Gedolim who use much smaller shiurim when it came to mitzvahs. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the Talmud of Vilna Gaon, is said to have been very makil, very lenient when it comes to shiurim. The way I heard it was that he would take a piece of matzah around the size of the palm of one's hand, okay? Again, the average person's hand. So that's significantly smaller than anything you'll find in a digest of Hilchos Pesach in 2012. Rabbi Schechter told me that his father-in-law was a Talmud of Reb Shimon Shkup in Europe, and one time there was he had a Seder together with some of the other Talmidim, and five students shared one matzah, one big hand-baked matzah at the Seder, and that was enough. Under the auspices of Reb Shimon Shkup, who was one of the great Rosh Yeshiva in that generation. So that approach seems to say, even though, again, this does not appear to be the most widely accepted opinion, that opinion would seem to accept that whatever is the size of commonly found amongst the olives in your generation, so that's what you use. That's what you use. The reason why that's not, again, accepted across the board is because there's a statement in the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Pesach which tells us that the size of an olive that we're dealing with is half the size of an egg. Some say a third of an egg, but let's say half the size of an egg for now. So an egg without the shell is 45 cubic centimeters. Okay, so if you divide that in half, you know, 22 and change, 22 and a half, so then that's not, that's about as much as three times or more of what we describe nowadays in terms of the size of our olives. Okay, so something's up. Could be that something changed. Could be that the size of olives that Chazal were describing are not the same size that we're dealing with. But that's step one in the complication of things. To make things a little more confusing, just for fun, is that there's another description of shiurim that's found in halacha. What I told you a second ago, that one egg is equal to two olives, that's what's found in Hilchos Pesach. Another place where we find a description of shiurim is in Hilchos Challah. In order to determine how much dough, when baked together, requires a bracha when you're separating the challah, or if it requires a separation of challah altogether, there's another discussion of shiurim over there. And if you calculate it carefully, because it's not just working with eggs and olives, it comes out that that is not in correspondence with the shiur that's found in it does not correspond to the shiur that's found in Hilchos Pesach. Let's see a little bit of that inside. This experimentation was done originally by the Noda Behuda, was definitely one of the great poskim of the last couple hundred years, and we're going to read a description of his conclusions from the Aruch HaShulchan. This is on the second page, what you have in front of you, the second side, next to the F41, at the top right. Okay, so Dash Echad Min HaGedolim Hirish HaOlam, one of the Gedolim. He's not referring to the Noda Behuda by name, but that's who he's talking about. Hirish HaOlam, he shook the world. Why? Because he took the two measurements, the one found in Hilchos Pesach that says one egg is two olives, and he took the other one in Hilchos Challah, and he found have a mechtza mikafi midas ha'etzboim. The amount found in Hilchos Pesach, that the one egg is two zaysim, is 50% of what is found in Hilchos Challah. Okay, over there, the measurement isn't given in eggs, it's given in fingers. Okay, meaning if you measured fingers and length and width and depth also to create a shear of volume, so it says this many fingers across, this many fingers this way and that way, and eventually you'll have the volume that we're talking about. So he says it comes out half. So there's one or two conclusions that you can come to. Either our fingers are twice the size of the fingers in the time of Chazal, people were much bigger back then. That's very hard to believe, that we're bigger than the previous generation. Because if anything, in history, we find that, again, at least in biblical times, people were much bigger. The only other way to reconcile this is not to say that our fingers are larger, but rather our eggs are smaller than the ones that were described in the time of Chazal. All the different shirim for all the different mitzvahs we find in halacha are actually really have to be doubled, because if the eggs that we're using, if one egg is two olives, but our eggs are half the size of the eggs in the time of Chazal, so really we have to double those eggs and come out with four kizaisim, basically. I mean, one egg of ours, we really need two eggs to come out with the two kazasim that are described. Yeah.
So what do we do then with the knowledge that we have that we are in fact larger historically now that we're healthier? That
right.
We probably should have bigger fingers.
So we'll go back a couple hundred years, you know, to where we can put this where it's better quantified. But can we go back 2,000 years? And know, do we have similar evidence? You can tell me better. What do we know about 2,000 years ago? That's the trick. So I don't have an answer to that question. Although if we have a chance, maybe we'll go a little bit further. A little bit of that is addressed. So in the next paragraph, he talks about how it's just very hard to accept that there has been this shrinking of the eggs. He talks about in Sivav, the next paragraph, the third line, the middle of the third line, Aval be'emes mi'medina l'medina lo nishtanu ha'beitzim. He says, lo nishtanu ha'beitzim. It's very hard to make this assessment in the first place, because in every different part of the world, eggs may be of different sizes. L'gamri, di'esh medina shar tarnigolim shalom metilim beitzim gedolim. There's some countries where the chickens there produce much larger eggs. V'esh medina shar metilos ketanos. Some make much smaller eggs. Kasher adanu b'chosh. He says, how do I know this firsthand? Shezeh erach shloshim shana. It's an unbelievable historical account here. 30 years ago, shehuvel medina shalonu, coming to our parts of Lithuania, tarnigolos mirachakim. They brought chickens from some other part of the world. Korum lahem praisisa o galansky. I don't know how you translate these, but that was the species that were brought from other parts of the world. And he said, lo and behold, when they brought these other breeds of chicken, to our part of the world, the eggs that they were laying were twice the size. So he says, why did they bring these chickens? Because if they had a much stronger breed of chicken, and they crossbreed them with the chickens that we have here, we can improve the quality and the strength and the size of the chickens that we're producing in our native country. So he says, accordingly, the size of eggs have gone down because of the mixture of the different chickens. Okay, that's for as far as that goes. Another example in Siv Zion he mentions is that when it comes to other halachas, the Gemara mentions that the size of a human mouth can accommodate two eggs. It can hold one egg. Okay, one chicken egg. Why that's relevant is not for now, but the Gemara makes that assessment. The size of an average human being, his mouth can hold one egg. So now, if you're going to tell me that we have to take one of our eggs, double its size, and say basically that a human can hold two eggs in his mouth, so that's very hard to imagine. It's really impossible. He says, I experimented, okay? I tried, and it doesn't work. You can't fit it there.
But if their fingers were twice as big as ours, then...
So, we're not suggesting that they were bigger. The only other way, you're saying if in fact they were bigger, so they might have been able to hold one. Interesting. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a good point. Be that as it may, okay. Just to get to the bottom line, to the Aruch HaShulchan, amongst others, even though Gedolim such as the Vilna Gaon and the Noda Bihuda I mentioned before, based on Noda Bihuda's experimentation, came to the conclusion that we do have to double the size of our shiurim. They, despite that fact, the Aruch HaShulchan and others says, no, the accepted minhag was not to double the shiurim. We have what's in front of us. We don't have to be researchers and see what things looked like 2,000 years ago. Chazal intended to give us halacha in a manner in which we could apply it based on what we have in front of us, and that is all that's necessary. So in the Aruch HaShulchan's house, they probably didn't have as much matzah as some people eat nowadays. So where does it come from that people have much more matzah than, again, you might derive from the shurim here? So the Mishnah Brura says that even though, again, there's what to question with this approach of doubling the shurim, let's make a compromise. The Mishnah Brura says, for halachas that pertain to mitzvahs d'oraisa, we will double the shir. Those that apply to d'rabbanans, we won't double the shir. Because a safek d'oraisa l'chomra, when it comes to a doubt regarding a Torah law, so you have to be machmir, so maybe we have to be concerned with this doubt, so we'll have twice as much matzah. When it comes to d'rabbanan, the rule is safek d'rabbanan l'kula. So maror, nowadays, maror is only d'rabbanan. So even if one doubles the shir when it comes to matzah, Baruch Hashem, you don't have to double the shir regarding maror, because that would certainly be difficult. But on that topic, just another ramification of this, it's a sort of a mnemonic, but it's also a little bit circular, sort of. Another shear that we have that's based on this these relationships between eggs and olives is the shear of a revius. A revius is a liquid measure, and when you fill a kiddush cup, so a kiddush cup has to have a minimum of a revius. Practically speaking, again, it's somewhere between around 3.5 ounces, maybe a little bit less. I think Ramosha Feinstein says 3.3 ounces. 3.3 to 4 ounces is probably what it's going to come to. The smaller shear, at least working with the metric system, is approximately, if we take that the ounce measurement and put it into the metric system, it's about 86 milliliters. Okay, so now those who advocate the smaller quantity say 86. Wait a second. The gematria of the word kos is 86. Beautiful. Okay, that's exactly what we're talking about. So the Chazon Ish and the Stipler Gaon, were of the opinion that it should be doubled. Okay, if you double it, it's not an actual, it's not exactly doubling it. It comes out to 150 milliliters. Okay, so it's not precise, but it's close to double. So they say, wait a second, you're going to challenge us from the gematria. The gematria of the words kos hagun, a proper kos, is 150. So, you can use, what do they say, you can use numbers to prove anything. 36% of all people know that. So the gematrias they work out depending on who you'd like to follow in this case. Okay, interesting, Rabbi Willig wrote an article in Pesach to Go for YU, going back maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where he details very clearly how much one should eat You know, if a person's sick, if they're not up to eating the larger shirim, you know, what's practical on Pesach. And he talks about this question of how things may or may not have changed over the years. He points to the fact that some Svarim note that archaeological evidence, getting back to your question before, not working on the size of people's bodies, but the eggs and fruits in times of Chazal, they had not changed so much. That's what the archaeology seems to indicate. But I found it convenient and relevant to what we were saying before, that he ends the article saying, when the Sanhedrin reconvenes, we'll be able to reevaluate exactly how our shiurim should be. So we are consistent as we move into our next subject. Okay. Something which I think gets a lot of attention and people hear about here and there on this subject is the question of lice, killing lice on Shabbos. Okay, there's a Gemara, which is, again, from today's science, is hard to understand. It's on your sheets, also the bottom box in the center of the page. Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Kuvzayin on Beis tells us, the Sanya Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Hahori Kina B'Shabbos, Kahori Gamal B'Shabbos. There are two opinions. The first opinion is Rabbi Eliezer. He says if you kill a louse on Shabbos, it's the same thing as killing a camel. You're not allowed to kill animals or people or anything alive, for that matter, on Shabbos. The reason for that, the Gemara tells us, is that there were animals that had to be slaughtered in the creation, in the building of the Mishkan, to get their hides, to get their to produce certain fabrics, etc. So, since killing was one of the things that had to be done to build the Mishkan, and we learn the malachos from the Mishkan, so killing animals, etc., is one of the things that we cannot do on Shabbos. So, Rabbi Elazar says it's all the same. Maskevla Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef asked the following question. We have another source which tells us, Ad kan lo pligi rabbanan aleid Rabbi Eliezer el bekina de'ena para v'rabba. The opinion of the Rabbanan, arguing on Rabbi Eliezer, is that a louse may be killed on Shabbos. Why? Because it does not procreate. It is not involved in pur revu. It does not reproduce the way other animals do. Aval shar shkatzim ramasim de'parin v'rabban lo pligi. The opinion of the Rabbanan is that there are certain insects, such as kinim, that may be killed on Shabbos, because they're different than the camels. They're not the same. Why? Because they don't reproduce in the same way other animals do. If you would find a mosquito, a mosquito does reproduce normally. So the Rabbanan would agree you can't kill it on Shabbos. But kinim, specifically, they say you are allowed to kill on Shabbos because they don't reproduce in the same way that that other organisms do. Okay, now, what is the basis for this? So if you look at some of the other halachic literature, the other option, if you say something is not does not reproduce normally, so the theory was, and this goes all the way up to pretty relatively recent times, from a scientific perspective, if an insect didn't reproduce normally, it was created from spoiling meat, spoiling fruits, etc. Okay, obviously we know Louis Pasteur in his experimentation found that was not actually the source of the production of these insects, but rather the meat just attracted them. But in the time of Chazal, it was a common belief that these animals were created from spoiling other garbage, etc. Okay, so now this is found in Shulchan Aruch, this halacha that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. Okay, and it comes up very practical. You have a kid who comes home from school, and there are lice going around in school, so you have to spray the kid's head. So am I allowed to spray the kid's head on Shabbos if I'm concerned that the spray is going to kill the lice? So again, strictly speaking, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it says without any exceptions, it's permitted. Now, how do we look at that? How do Poskim in the last couple hundred years since Pasteur, how do they look at the fact that we know, if you look carefully, you use a microscope, in fact, these organisms are reproducing like anything else. So there are a number of approaches to this. I'm just going to outline them briefly and try to focus on the ones that pertain to us a little bit more. One of the more popular sources cited on this topic is the Sefer Pachad Yitzchak. Pachad Yitzchak was an encyclopedic work in halacha. There's a more recent Sefer Pachad Yitzchak written by Rav Yitzchak Huttner, but that's within the last few decades. Pachad Yitzchak in 1750, the author was Rav Yitzchak Lomfranti, an Italian Talmud Chacham. And he notes that, you know, the lice that we're looking at in this part of the world certainly do reproduce. So what's going on? How am I allowed to kill them on Shabbos? Maybe I can't. So he wrote a letter to his Rebbe, and his Rebbe responded, no, if that's the reality that's described in the Gemara, there's nothing else to talk about. There's no reason to question it. And who are we to come along and change the halacha? Okay. So we'll come back to his approach in a moment, because that seems to be the one that needs a little more deeper understanding to see how we're going to contradict what we're looking at. But just to throw out there are a couple of other ways to look at it. Some say, again, this is what is found in the Sfarim, that perhaps it's a different species. Right? The evidence through omission is not going to help us over here. Just because everything we find nowadays is producing normally, that doesn't mean that there's a different species that's extinct now, but 2,000 years ago did live and was not reproducing normally. So you're going to tell me, but we have no halachic, we have no scientific framework for such a non-reproducing organism. So I'll get to that in a second. So there are those who say, yeah, okay, you're right. Let's act according to the science that we have in front of us, and don't kill the lice on Shabbos. You're right. You really can't. That's the bottom line. So now, what I would not have expected, actually, you know, let's talk about one more. There's one more popular approach. This is mentioned by Rav Dessler in the Mechta Me'Eliyahu, and this came up a few years ago. If you followed the there was another controversy regarding fish, bugs, and fish. Okay, that comes up every few years, and I think in 2010 it hit the news again. According to Rav Dessler, and again, others share a similar approach, it's not that we're not, it's not that we're denying the science. Yes, Chazal knew all along that these organisms always reproduce normally. However, if the reproduction of the animals, of the organisms, take place at a sub microscopic level, something that's not visible to the human eye, so we acknowledge that that's what's taking place, but from a halachic perspective, we're not concerned with it. The Aruch HaShulchan gives the following example. If you inhale air in the room, and then you would take that air and look at the oxygen under a microscope, you'll find hundreds of thousands of microorganisms floating in the air that you can never see unless you you had the proper equipment to see it. Nevertheless, the Torah doesn't say that it's also to breathe because you're going to be inhaling little bugs. Okay, but they're there. Okay, so what's the what's the answer? The answer is that Lo nitna Torah lo malachi asharis, the Gemara says in a few places. Torah is not given to malachim, Torah is given to human beings. So whatever is part of our normal human experience without special apparatus, such as a microscope, is all that we're required to pay attention to be concerned about. So therefore, an organism that is not visible to the naked eye doesn't have to come into the halachic discussion. So perhaps these lice were, never came into the halachic reality of what we call parin v'ravin, reproducing, because the process of reproduction that they undergo is not visible to the naked eye. And that came up in the fish controversy, because fish were found in certain parts of the... bugs were found in certain parts of the fish that cause halachic issues in terms of the consciousness of the fish. It seemed that those who were permitting the fish were working on the assumption that, as the Gemara seems to describe it, that the bugs are created in the flesh of the fish. Now, we know that that's not true. We know that little eggs may be laid or swallowed by the fish, and they'll end up in parts of the fish, and then they'll hatch, and then the microorganisms, the worms, will come out. But it's not that they're created from the flesh of the fish. But a similar answer was given, that perhaps what halacha is referring to, Chazal knew that the flesh of the fish wasn't creating new bugs, but since at that stage of their development, when they're, again, still in the egg part of their life cycle, they're not visible to the naked eye, and therefore they don't have to be reckoned with from a halacha perspective. Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Is that the New York City water controversy?
So, believe it or not, that was the initial reaction. Everyone's knee-jerk reaction is, oh, it's going to be fine because after all, you can't see them anyway. The truth is, you can. If you know what to look for, you can. Now, you won't see them in every glass of water. I think going back, it's a while ago, it's almost 7 or 8 years since the New York City water controversy started, but they did experimentation here in Washington Heights because it obviously impacted the yeshiva, YU, this side of the Heights. I should say it affected our community on that side of the Heights. still got to get used to that. And I believe the evidence was to the effect 1 in 8 glasses had a bug. Okay, so each glass you poured didn't necessarily have a problem, didn't have something floating in it. But that's what I'm saying. If you had the right quantities and you knew what to look for, yes, I saw a few of them. You know, there was a guy who brought in a little beaker with a lot of bugs floating around, and you could see them. You just have to know what to look for. But that's definitely an important factor. There are places where the bugs are just not visible, and then as a result, you don't have to. I'm sure there's amoeba, whatever is floating around in water all over the world that we just can't see, without a microscope. Okay, so now the two approaches to this question that I want to focus on for our purposes is one thing, number one, I never would have thought would be relevant. Getting back to our real subject of our conversation is Nishtan HaTeva, where has nature changed? So some say, well, maybe nature has changed in this regard. Maybe the lice in the time of Chazal did not reproduce naturally. They had some other form of reproduction, and nowadays ours do. So it doesn't really, again, as I said before, it doesn't really seem to fit in our scientific framework. But I'm going to read to you a piece from someone who knows a lot of science. Those of you familiar who've ever read Rabbi Bleich, Rabbi J. David Bleich, he's a phenomenal, phenomenally knowledgeable person in every area of information in this world. So he writes something which, again, intuitively, and I'm just speaking for myself, if we're not oriented in the scientific method, it wouldn't have occurred to us. This is from a piece that he wrote in the journal Tradition about 2 or 3 years ago. Ascription of scientific error to Chazal in this matter was rejected by virtually all subsequent rabbinic authorities, not only for doctrinal reasons, but also because they understood full well, as does any person who has even a passing familiarity with philosophy of science, so I'm not on that list, that Pasteur's rejection of spontaneous generation is an empirical generalization and hence not logically compelling. So now, I don't even remember who my high school biology teacher was, but I like to call him up, and he gave me the impression that that there wasn't anything to talk about after Pasteur. And here, Rabbi Bleich posits that it's not logically compelling at all. Namely, indeed, physicists, and he's citing Path Integrals in Physics, Volume 2, Quantum Field Theory, Statistical Physics, and Other Modern Applications, Philadelphia, 2001. Indeed, physicists have demonstrated that a massless subatomic particle known as a Goldstone boson can be, I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. Boson, okay. Can be spontaneously created in a vacuum and do not regard the generation of life in a laboratory as merely grist for science fiction. Even more strikingly, evolutionists would have us believe that all life on planet Earth rose out of some type of primordial chemical soup. Let us remember that spontaneous generation is not synonymous with generation ex nihilo. Chazal asserted that kinim are generated by sweat and parasites by the body of their hosts. Granted, the lice we observe are all generated sexually. Nevertheless, there is no scientific reason to assume that an asexually reproducing species did not exist in Talmudic times, but became extinct over the course of millennia, or that members of that species metamorphosed into sexually reproducing lice through, interspecies evolutionary processes. Okay, so if that made if that was not something surprising to you, it was surprising to me because we don't usually think in those terms that maybe it's not so crazy that things are as different as he's describing. So that's the basis for the argument of Nishtan HaTeva, that maybe our lives are different than they were in the time of Chazal. The approach I wanted to look at a little more in the last few minutes over here does not make that assertion. But actually requires a little more emuna. Not simply in the words of Chazal, it's not a matter of saying that, well, Chazal said it, so it's right regardless of what we find, but rather, there's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which tells us something very interesting, and we could give a whole shiur just talking about what this Gemara means. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells us that if you break down the entirety of human history, so it really should be divided into three different eras. The first 2,000 years since the creation of the world were known as the Alpayim Tohu. Okay, Tohu Vavohu, like we find in the beginning of Bereishis. Tohu means all mixed up, hefker, no organization, no structure. The second 2,000 years were the Alpayim Torah. Okay, 2,000 years of Torah, which, again, the year 2000, by our count, is not exactly when the Torah was given, but, again, there's an approximation. The last 2,000 years, going, again, starting about 2,000 years after the Torah was given, is known as the Alpaim of Yemos HaMashiach. 2,000 years in which there's a potential for Mashiach to come, which, by the way, Rabbi Kiva, in his belief that Bar Kochva was Mashiach, obviously did not subscribe to this tradition, but this tradition that's recorded in the Gemara was that 2,000 years, these 2,000 years that we live in right now, are the years in which there's a potential for Yemos HaMashiach. Okay, so now, what is the significance of saying there are 2,000 years of Torah? So what, we don't learn Torah anymore? We're sitting here right now learning Torah. So what does it mean that there were those 2,000 years of Torah, and then afterwards there weren't? So if you look at history, the end of that period of 2,000 years, going from Kabbalah's Torah forward, basically coincides with the completion of the Gemara. Okay, the Ravina and Avashi were the Amoraim who put together the Talmud as we have it, and the significance of that stamp of approval in completing the Gemara that we have in our hands was not just putting everything down on paper, but it signified the end of an era during which Hashem, through divine providence, had mandated that that would be the period of time in which halacha for all time going forward would be determined. And as a result, even if the reality, the science changes, or our perception of science changes, or the manner in which we describe the world around us changes, it doesn't matter. Not because we're ignoring the science, not because we're ignorant of it, but because Hashgacha Pratis had it work out that the halacha would be, again, would follow a certain pattern based on the realities described at the end of that 2,000-year period. Interesting. This is an opinion, this is an approach advanced by the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is also known for a somewhat paralleled opinion. Many raise the question over the years. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, so the Shulchan Aruch is basically comprised of the majority, the consensus of the Rush, of the Rif, of the Rambam, the predominant poskim, predominant Rishonim, that he was working from. Hundreds of years later, after the Shulchan Aruch was published, there were many other Rishonim that their manuscripts were found, they were unearthed. The Vatican gave us a copy of a book we never had before. So some poskim say, well, you know, now we have access to information we didn't have 500 years ago. And if the Shulchan Aruch originally was counting up, you know, trying to figure out what the majority was, now when we have additional opinions, let's throw them into the mix and reverse what the previous ruling was. The Chazon Ish writes, and again, not everyone agrees to this, but the Chazon Ish was of the opinion that, once again, there was a certain siyata d'shmaya. When the Shulchan Aruch, recorded the rulings that he did, it was done with all of the halachic material that was available to him at the time, in the 1500s, and there was a reason why God decided to reveal to us other opinions and other manuscripts hundreds of years later, and did not make those available to the poskim who were writing in earlier generations. Because there's a certain hashgacha pratis in halacha, not only hashgacha pratis in the way the world works, events that take place. So it's a very interesting chiddush. One thing which I think is interesting, going back to our fish and meat discussion last week, is that there's a Kabbalistic sefer known as the Sefer Hakana, which was written by Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, a Tana living around the time when the Mishnayos were completed. Again, it was if we ascribe, and we generally do, the Zohar to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, so they were living at a similar time period, time of the Tanaim. So this Kabbalistic sefer was, a parallel work. So he writes over there that the danger inherent, notwithstanding the recent science revelation you shared with me earlier, but the danger that the Gemara describes of eating fish and meat together will not extend beyond the year 5,000. I think that's what he says. Which means that Bizman Hazeh, in the last 1,000 years or so, a little bit less, that actually explains why we don't have any scientific evidence of such a danger, because it was already predicted back then that nature of the combination of the fish and meat would not exist. The significance of that is that it sort of sheds light in the direction of what the Chazon Ish is saying, that there was a period of time in which science and halacha, the way they interact, were determined. Because it said, yes, we know that right now a certain reality exists, and we know that a certain reality will not exist in the future, but at the same time, the Gemara records that danger unequivocally. It doesn't say, oh, don't mix fish and meat together now, but if you're living in the future, when you're reading this Gemara, it won't apply. No, so there was an acknowledgement that the science may not always remain the same, or the perception of science may not always remain the same, but af al pi kein, nonetheless, the halacha still will remain according to the way it was originally passed. Okay, there's a lot more to discuss, but I thank you for coming tonight. If I'm not sure exactly where the shiurim are going to take place in the future once construction begins, but I hope to see you in the future. Thank you very much. Have a good night.